And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper still out with his back injury, but planning his return. And we're not certain when it will be, but it is in the works. So we're really happy to report that. With the obesity epidemic in America, many studies are being conducted on everything from the impact of obesity on America's productivity and global competitiveness to the ways excess fat changes physical and mental health. But a barely discussed consequence of obesity is its effect on the love lives and sexuality of that population, and it's a vital aspect for the tens of millions of overweight and obese Americans in the bedroom and beyond. Joining us now is senior health policy correspondent with Kaiser Health News, Sarah Varney. Her stories air regularly on NPR and the PBS NewsHour and appear in the New York Times, Washington Post, and USA Today, among other publications. She's written XL Love, How the Obesity Crisis is Complicating America's Love Life. And Sarah Varney joins us from San Francisco. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Everything okay there after the earthquake?
Yeah, I was just checking in with one of the folks here at KQED who has a sister who lives up in Napa. We got quite a shake on Sunday morning around 3:20 in the morning.
Right.
But it's obviously the folks in Napa who have really been dealing with the brunt of it.
Yeah, and a lot of destruction there, I've heard. So getting to your – go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, yes, the photographs, of course, from downtown Napa have been pretty troublesome.
Yeah, it's really a shame. A lot of old buildings. So getting to your book, I'd like to begin, if we could, with the statistics. What are we looking at nationally and regionally? Importantly, you mentioned that in terms of the obesity epidemic.
Well, really, if you think back to people who grew up in the 1950s or 60s, it was very, growing up with another child who was obese or even overweight was still somewhat of a rarity. Today in the United States, 2 out of 3 American adults are either overweight or obese. 1 out of 3 are obese. So you're talking about more than 150 million Americans who have excess weight and for whom they're dealing with the physical issues, the mental issues, the walking through the world and probably feeling a lot of discrimination and judgment passed on them. But they're also really trying to deal with this in their personal lives as well.
Were you able to determine why they're on the rise and why
it's
still, on the rise as opposed to declining with all the research and everything that we have? It's almost counterintuitive in all the surgeries now that we have, the techniques for reducing weight. Why is it still on the rise?
Well, there's certainly been a lot of authors that have taken up this question. Certainly Michael Pollan, Mark Bittman, Dr. Mark Hyman. There's a lot of folks who have been looking at our food supply, have been looking at the level of activity that we have in our lives. And once those things were put into motion, it's very hard to undo. So I think we are really still, many people would say, very much in the beginning of this obesity epidemic. Mm. We thought we saw some hopeful news in the data last year when we thought we saw a slight decrease in the percentage of toddlers who were overweight and obese. That data now, we're not so sure that may have just been a blip. So we're going to really need to see sort of year over year whether or not, at least among the youngest children, we're starting to reverse that trend. But you can think about it, back in the 1950s and 60s, it was almost impossible to find a toddler who was actually obese unless there was something wrong with them.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's much more common. And so I think the problem becomes, and I talk about this in the book, that, for kids who grow up, for kids who gain a lot of weight during adolescence, they are almost guaranteed to be overweight as adults. Something about 80% for women and about 90% for men. If they were obese as children, they will be obese as adults.
Let's define at this point what it means to be overweight, obese, or morbidly obese in terms of body mass indexes. That's how it's calculated, correct?
That's generally how it's calculated, right? So being overweight is about 25 BMI. Being obese is about 30 BMI. And anything really over 35 BMI is somebody would be considered morbidly obese.
So I said in the intro, there's been so much written on the impact of obesity on our physical health. We hear about it all the time, but not on the personal lives and sexual development and sex lives of those who are affected. How did you become interested in this aspect?
So I've been a health reporter for a number of years now and have, of course, as many other health reporters, have really focused on obesity and looked at all of the medical complications, the health complications from obesity. You know, so I spent a lot of time interviewing people about diabetes, heart disease, strokes, increased risks of breast cancer, all these other things. And it always just struck me every time I'd finish one of these stories, I just wanted to know a lot more about how is this really affecting the rest of your life? I grew up with a grandmother who was morbidly obese, so I saw the way the world treated her. It was not a conversation. She was an old Yankee, so it wasn't really the conversation I could have with her. But I started to get really interested, and I felt like, you know, every once in a while there would be a story that would come out that would look at, you know, sexual functioning among overweight women or sexual functioning after bariatric surgery. And there would just be these sort of one-off stories. And I just got very interested in trying to understand how obesity might be changing other aspects of our lives. And there was a wonderful editor, NPR, Steve Drummond, who curated a series at NPR that we did a number of years ago called Living Large. And the idea was to really look at how is obesity changing life in America. So beyond just the medical and the physical complications, the mental health issues, how is our society changing? I mean, it's as if, I say this in the book, you know, it's as if over the course of two or three generations, Americans suddenly grew a foot taller. So imagine sort of walking around the world and seeing everybody be a foot taller all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. You know, it sparks your curiosity to understand a little bit about how is that changing just social norms? How is it changing institutions like marriage and rituals like dating and courtship? So that's what sparked my interest.
I just want to mention here, Sarah, that you point out the fact that you're not referring to the love and sex lives of all overweight or obese individuals or couples. You do say that many of them do have fulfilling romantic and sexual experiences and relationships, right? So I just want to mention that here.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, this is the difficult thing for a lot of folks when you start talking about something like weight and certainly something like intimate relationships. You have to imagine that most of the studies that I tried to gather in this book, the social science, the medical research, these are based on, you know, a population of people. So just like with, say, smoking, right? I mean, for a long time, we would do these studies and we were able, finally, the scientists were able to say that smoking increases your risk of emphysema and of lung cancer. Does that mean that there are not people out there who can smoke their whole lives and don't get those things? Absolutely.
Right.
But what we know from looking at the data is that the vast majority of people or the most of the people will sort of fall within this realm. So absolutely, there are people out there who are overweight, who have or are obese and have wonderful relationships with their partners. And you meet some of those people in this book as well. I mean, I think this book is what I actually just heard from one of the women who's featured in the book. And she just said, thank you so much for drawing attention to this and for calling attention to obesity and for calling attention to the fact that this is an important part of our lives, and we shouldn't just be told that we have to leave it behind or that we should just sort of think ourselves out of this. So this is very real, and we really want to talk about it.
You know, before we get to some of the people in the book and some of the facts about, you know, starting at the neonatal intensive care unit where you start the book in Mississippi, I just wanted to ask you, because it seems that you form such close relationships with many of your subjects in the book, and I'm wondering how you were able to gain their trust and get them to open up about what's really such a delicate, personal, and often shameful issue.
Yeah, and I really salute the people who agreed to be in this book. Most of them use their real names. We did change the names of the people who are under 18, but other than that, almost everybody except for one couple agreed to use their real names. And that was I really wanted that. I really wanted these to be real people who are identified, you know, in their communities, who are coming out and telling their stories. I think it's much more powerful that way. But you're absolutely right. I mean, you as a radio host and as a reporter and other reporters out there, this is a big part of our job. And it's about gaining trust. It's about letting them know that I'm going to tell your story truthfully, and I'm going to treat you with compassion. But you're right. I mean, this was a long process in trying to find people who would be willing to tell their stories. You know, you might get 6 months into it, and then they would say, you know what, something's happened. I just don't want my name out there, or I don't feel comfortable anymore. And you just have to respect that. But you're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of these folks I'm still in touch with. I care very deeply about them and their families. And I feel really fortunate that they trusted me to tell their story.
How did you meet most of them?
Yeah, so there's a fantastic group here in San Francisco, that Dr. Rabkin, who is a big bariatric surgeon here, he runs, I think, probably one of the best bariatric surgery support groups in the country. And there's a testament. The testament to that is that there are 40 or 50 people who come together in San Francisco every month. Many of them don't live in San Francisco. In fact, I would say the majority don't. They come from all over Northern California. There was even a family, I think, that flew in one time from Chicago. There's folks that come from Nevada. And they come once a month to talk about either pre-operative or post-operative, what their struggles are around their surgery and around their weight loss. So I had connected with him and one of his staff members early on, and he agreed to stand in front of the group and say, there's this reporter, she's coming to us with this request. And there are a few people who raised their hands. And so I followed up with them. And then otherwise, it was a lot of spreading the word. It was a lot of calling different, you know, marriage and family therapists. It was for the teenagers, it was a lot of going onto Reddit, which is a social networking site essentially online, and really diving deep into those networks, putting out a lot of feelers and saying, are there folks that can come forward and talk with me?
We're speaking with Sarah Varney. She's written XL Love, How the Obesity Crisis is Complicating America's Love Life. We're going to take a break, but before we do, I want to ask you if weight gain or obesity has complicated your relationship or your love life, or if it hasn't. And are you able to talk about it with your partner, or is that too painful for you, or is it too shameful for you, or are you unable or unwilling to have a relationship because of your weight? Either way, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or radio at WLRN.org. That break, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to Tuesday's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman visiting with Sarah Varney. She's a senior health policy correspondent with Kaiser Health News and has reported extensively on health policy and health disparities within the public health sphere, and has contributed, as she mentioned, to NPR's Living Large. It's a series on how obesity is changing life in America. The name of her book is XL Love, How the Obesity Crisis is Complicating America's Love Life. And I'll give the number again, is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. If you're in a position either that you don't date because of your weight, or if you do and it's complicated your love life. So, Sarah, beginning back in Mississippi in this neonatal intensive care unit, where the babies of obese mothers who suffer from hypertension or diabetes are often premature, tell us about that and why you're in Mississippi.
Sure. So one of the reasons I wanted to go to Mississippi was obviously it's really been at the vanguard, in a sense, of the obesity epidemic in the United States. They've been dealing with obesity for many, many years, and really the rest of the country has, in a sense, now just caught up to them. So I was very interested to go there to talk to pediatric endocrinologists and pediatricians and other physicians who are seeing patients who have severe obesity. I was also, though, curious, and we can talk about this a little bit later if you'd like, but just in terms of what happens when the vast majority of people around you are obese and overweight, does that change the dynamics, particularly for teens who are out dating or for people who are in their 20s and 30s and are out dating? If you look around and everyone around you is obese and overweight, does that somehow lessen the discrimination against being overweight or obese? So I wanted to start with the neonatal intensive care unit because it's absolutely fascinating and very sad. It's obviously Jackson, Mississippi is not a big city. It has one of the largest neonatal intensive care units in the country, and it's just vast. It's sort of two rooms, but they're connected, and it's almost a football field long. Mm. And when you look out, you know, you see these balloons, and you see saying, you know, it's a boy, it's a girl, and lots of concerned parents sitting around all wrapped up in gloves tending to their children. But when you talk to the staff there, what they'll tell you is that many of these children are born premature, extremely premature, and it's often because the mothers have diabetes, weight-induced diabetes, or hypertension or other problems. And the babies can be born either incredibly small. I mean, you're really talking about it almost doesn't even look human. It looks like I say in the book, it looks like a kitten, a translucent kitten, if that. And then there are other babies that are enormous. They're born at 12 pounds, even 14 pounds. And these are babies oftentimes of the diabetic mothers that have grown very fast in the womb, but the rest of their organs haven't really kept up. So their lungs haven't really grown as fast as the rest of their bodies have. So when they're born, they actually still need to be on a ventilator because their lungs just can't support them yet.
It's very, it's so sad because, and then the mothers, I mean, how did they have a lot of remorse because of the situation with their children?
I really tried to not have that conversation with them at that time. I mean, it's a very difficult moment, obviously, for them. But I did certainly talk to the head of the neonatal intensive care unit, and I did actually ask him that question. And he said what's sad for him is that they'll have parents who come back in two or three babies, you know, an older, they'll give birth several more times, and they'll continue to have not had their diabetes under control or not really address their weight issue. Mm-hmm. And so the next baby comes and it's the same situation over and over again. And I think it's very disturbing for a lot of the folks who work there, but also, you know, incredibly difficult to get a handle on weight. And I think that's something that you really hear from the people in the book, which is there is no easy solution to this. And, you know, I already feel bad enough about myself,
right,
that I did this, that, you know, don't put it on me as well.
Right, right. Well, let's move on to adolescence. I was really fascinated by that, how adolescence affects especially adolescent girls, their sexual development and their puberty, which they have earlier.
Yeah, so this is really interesting. So physicians have known for a long time that weight is very much linked to when girls get their periods, for instance, or when they even just start developing, when puberty begins. So, you know, puberty begins with the breasts budding, with pubic hair, and then eventually menstruation. And what you find in a place like Mississippi, but we're really finding, scientists are finding all over the country, is that puberty is starting much earlier now. And that is very much linked to weight. And there is a sort of a kaleidoscope of things happening in a girl's body that lead to puberty. There may be other reasons why girls are having early puberty as well, including, you know, chemicals in the environment and all these other things. But we do know that weight is one of the primary factors for when a girl gets her period. And what they're seeing in Mississippi, and I tell the story of this doctor in the Delta, which is obviously a very poor part of Mississippi, where he has girls who are 5 and 6 years old who are coming in with pubic hair, and he's having to give them hormone shots to stave off their pubertal development. I then went and talked to the chief pediatric endocrinologist in Jackson, who sees cases from all over Mississippi, and, you know, she is running around trying to handle all of these cases, both boys and girls. What she sees with the boys is, you know, we think, oh, well, he's just put on a lot of weight and eventually he'll kind of run it off. What they're seeing in Mississippi and they're seeing in many parts of the country are young boys who have excess weight who are actually developing breast tissue. So this isn't just fat that, you know, you could eventually burn off, but it's actual tissue. And one of the concerns is we know that obesity is very much linked to increased risk, significantly increased risk for breast cancer. And what we don't really know is what does that mean for these boys as they get older? But it is a serious concern for them. So one of the experiments that I talk about in the book that I thought was really fascinating to try and untangle what might be going on here was there was an experiment done in Madison, Wisconsin with these rhesus monkeys where they took monkeys from the same colony, so they're genetically related. They're in sterile environments so they can control the chemicals that they come into contact with. And then they just feed one group of monkeys a low-calorie or healthy diet, and then they feed the other monkeys, these female monkeys, a higher-calorie diet. And what they find is that the monkeys that are being fed the higher-calorie diet start menstruating much earlier. So this was one of the ways to start to understand, at least in monkeys, but, you know, there's certainly a correlation to humans as well, how our high-fat diet, our high-calorie diet is affecting the development of girls in particular.
And another thing that was interesting was that although the overweight teenage girls may have developed earlier, they didn't necessarily have sex earlier. But when they did have sex, the girls who were heavier, they had much riskier sex, including unprotected sex and having more partners. Why was that? Is it because of their self-image or their self-worth?
So I talked to talked to many young girls about this, but I also talked to a lot of therapists who work with girls and adolescent psychologists. And what they'll say is, and there's one woman in the book who really describes this, I think, quite heartbreakingly, where she says, you know, you're an overweight girl. You haven't had a lot of attention. So some guy comes up to you at a party and he starts flirting with you and he kind of, you know, presses you into sex and you agree. And so now you think that this is the way that you're going to get attention and that this is the only way that anybody's going to fawn all over you mm-hmm. is if you do this. So you then have this girl who goes throughout the rest of her teenage years sort of believing that about herself, internalizing that. But then you have to remember, then she goes off to college or she goes into community college or she goes and gets her first job when she's 18 or 19. And she's still has those same ideas. And because we obviously develop, human development is cumulative, we're building off of our previous experiences. When she starts entering into her early 20s, she's going out into the dating world believing that about herself. So because these things are cumulative, those early experiences are really important to get right, if you will. And it's true that we know that girls who are overweight and obese, but particularly girls who are obese, tend to not have sex as early as, quote, normal weight girls. But when they do choose to have sex, the sex is much riskier. So as you mentioned, they have multiple sex partners. They will often, there's a much higher rate of not using a condom. Mm-hmm. There's more anal sex, if I can say that. So, you know, these are risky things for young kids, teenagers to be encountering. And what I found really interesting was that when you look at the data, even while you see the obesity epidemic spreading across the country and more kids becoming obese and also the levels of extreme obesity increasing, that this does not change. So it's not like we're seeing obese girls now just because there's more of them that these sexual behaviors are actually changing.
And the thing also that was interesting was you found that boys would have sex with overweight girls but wouldn't date them even when the boys themselves were large. And that was pretty interesting as well.
It's interesting, you know, when you talk to boys and it was, you know, you think, oh, well, you want to talk about weight and you want to talk about intimacy and these kinds of things. It's going to be really difficult to get young or yet boys to talk to you. But I actually found that boys and young men were very eager to talk about this. It was oftentimes difficult to hear what they had to say, but nonetheless, it was really interesting to hear their perspective. I think for boys, what you hear from the adolescent psychologist and what you hear from the boys themselves is that I may be a bigger boy, but my size kind of carries with it an intimidation. So whereas a bigger girl might feel, you know, she's discriminated against, she might be shunned, for a bigger boy, they can play football, they can play soccer or baseball, right. They can kind of use their size, and it doesn't seem to be an impediment to them making friends. They did say that it actually, though, is an impediment to them dating. And dating and sex are obviously two very different things. And when you look at the research, you know, just because you're able to have sex doesn't necessarily mean that you're dating and that you're starting to build relationships, dating relationships. But it's true that I heard from many of the boys, the bigger boys themselves, this phrase NFC. You hear it from boys all over the country, no fat chicks. And they'll say, this is the mantra at my school, that you don't date them. You may have sex with them because that earns you, in sort of economic parlance, that kind of earns you, you know, credit and status among your friends, but you don't want to date them. And I mean, it's really brutal, brutal stuff. And I, as a parent, obviously, it's heartbreaking to think that this is the world that your child is kind of entering into. But I think it's really important for parents, particularly parents who have kids who are overweight or obese, to understand that this is not just a medical issue or a health issue, but that there, and it's not just a bullying issue, but that there are real other sort of human development processes that are happening that they need to be aware of.
We're speaking with Sarah Varney. She's a reporter and a senior health policy correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Her book is XL Love, How the Obesity Crisis is Complicating America's Love Life. We need to take a break. We're going to come back and take some calls and your emails. So please stay with us and we'll be right back. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman visiting with Sarah Varney, a senior health policy correspondent with Kaiser Health News. She's written XL Love, How the Obesity Crisis is Complicating America's Love Life. And as I said, we're going to take your calls and your emails. But just one question before we do that, Sarah. I'd like you to talk about, because you mentioned the breasts in young boys, but You say that the effects of obesity were much more physical in men, where they're more psychological in women. But let's talk about the obesity affecting their men's physiology, their hormones, and their sexual functioning.
So this is really interesting. And when you, it's perhaps surprising to know that urologists have been on the front lines of how obesity is affecting sexual functioning for years. So what we know, for particularly for men who have what we would consider belly fat, right, a lot of fat, what's called adipose tissue, there's a particular type of enzyme in that fat that actually converts testosterone into estrogen. So it's a well-known established medical fact that overweight men and obese men are much more likely to have low testosterone. So when these men would come into urologists saying, I have, you know, I'm feeling down, I'm feeling depressed, or I don't get excited very easily. When you talk to the urologist, they'll say that many of these patients are overweight. And there's several options for them. They can lose weight. And there's been many, many studies that have shown that when men lose weight, that their natural testosterone production increases. Or sometimes the urologist will treat them with testosterone in order to sort of jumpstart the process and encourage that, which hopefully they think will help encourage them to lose a little bit of weight. So there are a lot of... It's a much more sort of physiological process for men in terms of the relationship between weight and sexual functioning than it is for women. There's other things as well. There's diabetes, of course, which we know is when you're overweight and particularly when you're obese, or you have a significant increased risk of diabetes. As you know, diabetes is a disease where you can get a lot of tingling in the extremities, in the feet, and in the hands. Mm-hmm. You have loss of nerve sensation in those places. And one of the urologists reminded me that the penis is an extremity. And so you'll have diabetic men, obese diabetic men, who will also lose sensation in their penis as well. And when this progresses to a certain point, you can't really get it back. I mean, you can start to treat the diabetes, but once there's been significant nerve damage, that's very difficult to tend to. We also know, for instance, that many years ago when Viagra first came out, that there were men, about 5 years after Viagra came out, there were a lot of men who were showing up with heart attacks. And at first there was this concern that the Viagra was actually causing the heart attacks. Well, they found out it wasn't that at all, but that men who were coming in with erectile dysfunction actually were showing early signs of heart disease, that in fact the arteries that feed the penis are very small, they're very narrow, and that they would get sort of gunked up, if you will. And so in a sense, erectile dysfunction has now become, among urologists, this is now very established around the country, and around the world, really, is now an early indicator, perhaps, of heart disease. So men who present with erectile dysfunction are often tested for heart disease. So for men, the implications are much more obvious, in a sense, in that a urologist can look at that, they can know it, whereas for women, there are fewer it's, as you say, it's a much more sort of psychological problem.
I'd like to get Mary on Delray Beach, who wants to talk about the subject. Hi, Mary. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Bonnie. Thank you so much. And Sarah, thank you so much as well for bringing this entire issue sort of out of the closet. I am a 50-year-old woman and by all rights, incredibly blessed and very, very satisfied with my life. But I was an XL teen. And the residual effects of being a large child have carried with me my entire life. And when I was young, in the 60s, my mother used to take me to a chubby girl's store to shop. And she thought it was the greatest experience in the world. She was a charming woman and had all the good intentions. But that has really scarred me, as have many of my risky behaviors that came along with being overweight, as you mentioned. I think what I'm trying to say here is I'm wondering, in your book, if you actually interviewed any women who are of an older age, mature women who... again, by all rights now, are not XL, but were, and how they're dealing with intimacy in their lives today, because I still have problems with that.
That is so interesting, Mary, because I wanted to bring up Dana Engelhart later, but I guess perhaps now, Sarah, you want to bring up Dana now?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So there are many women in the book who are over 50, including one of the central characters. Her name is Dana Engelhart. She grew up in the late 1960s, 70s, actually, in California. She herself, there are people in the book who very much mimic your own story, who were bigger as kids and then have really been dealing with the consequences of that throughout the rest of their lives. So absolutely, there are those people. Dana, she was not particularly big as a child, although her parents, kind of sound like your parents maybe, really focused a lot on her weight. Every week on Friday, she would have to get on the scale. Her parents were very working class parents. They just weren't, in a sense, thought that they were doing the right thing. You know, I think all of us as parents, we think we're doing the right thing. And then, oh, my Lord, years later, they end up in therapy. But, you know, so she ended up getting this real, obviously being very concerned about, was she gaining too much weight? Was she not? And then by the time she was 18, she'd finished high school. She married and had a child and started to gain significant amount of weight. So by the time she's, 19, 20, she's particularly heavy. And everybody around her is letting her know it, as if she didn't know it herself. And this then becomes essentially the theme of her entire life. And she goes on to divorce this early husband. Was not a great match. She had a second husband who died of cancer, and now she has this third husband who's a wonderful, wonderful man who's always been very supportive of her. Married her when she was a heavier woman, but then as they moved on in their lives, she gained more and more and more weight. And then by the time she reaches really her top weight, she's a small woman, a short woman. She's 265, 285 pounds. Wow. She's incredibly uncomfortable. She comes home at night. She's a nurse, so she spends a lot of time on her feet. She comes home at night, and her knees are just killing her. She has sleep apnea, so she has to sleep with one of these CPAP machines. So you can imagine, she's at war with herself physically. She is in pain a lot of the time, but she's also just at war with herself emotionally and mentally. She describes herself as, quote, the unlikable fat girl, and she doesn't buy it when her husband says to her, I love you, I find you attractive, I want you. She just can't believe it because she can't think, well, how could anybody want me? I look like a, quote, monster. And so this causes a huge rift, as you can imagine, in their relationship, and a real cooling of their physical relationship. And then finally, there just gets to be this point, and I hope you'll read the book, because I think she tells a very compelling story where she just says, I can't do this anymore. I'm worried that I'm going to lose my job and I'm going to lose my health insurance and who's going to take care of the kids. It really becomes a practical problem. So she decides to have bariatric surgery. We then meet her after she's had the surgery, after she's lost 100 pounds or so. And she's been very successful at the surgery. She's very diligent about following the protocols and going to group therapy to talk about the weight loss and her, what was essentially a food addiction. You don't get to be that big unless food plays an oversized role in your life. And she tells this moment where they're sitting on the couch. She's in the chair, and I think Larry's on the couch, and they're watching television. And she's waiting for her husband essentially to kind of be excited about her again. She thinks, oh, look at me. I've lost all this weight. And he just says, what does he say? He says, I forgot how to read her signs. It had been so long that they had a physical relationship. That they really had to start over again and really talk with each other about what their relationship was going to look like. So it's not as if, weight loss is this great panacea. In some ways, right, it can actually kick up a whole lot of other stuff for people. In their case, they made it through. And I think they would say that they have a stronger relationship because they went through this together. I talked to other women, and you'll meet other women in the book who are also in their 50s and 60s. You even meet some women who are in their 70s who would say, I was married to a kind of a crummy guy who treated me not in a nice way. And after I lost a bunch of weight, or after I decided, after I kind of got myself confidence, I decided that's not the relationship for me. I don't want to be in that.
Well, I think that this is very, very empowering for me, and I'm certainly going to read your book. I am in a great relationship. I'm actually getting married in a couple of months. My fiance couldn't be any better of a guy than he is and thinks I'm fabulous. It's in my head. It's residual from when I was a child. I am no longer overweight. I'm very active. I'm very happy, but it is in my head. And I'll tell you, intimately, I still think I might not measure up for him, even though he's never made mention. And I think if he was listening to this, he'd be very surprised to hear.
Right.
So I'm really, really grateful for you for sort of taking this all out of the closet. It's really made a very big impression on me. And I am going to read that book.
Okay, Mary. Well, thanks so much.
And congratulations on your upcoming nuptials.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. And we're going to talk to Lisa in Hollywood. Hi, Lisa. Welcome.
Hi, how are
you? Hi, welcome.
You know, I just wanted to say thank you so much for bringing up this topic. But I would like to say that I grew up as an overweight child, basically. And I always had this sense of needing to measure up, et cetera, et cetera. And then my parents had taken me on trips to the Caribbean as I got older, and also to West Africa. We had gone to Ghana. And my whole life changed because their perception of weight was completely different than it was here in the United States. And so that is something that, you know, I mean, I kind of lived a dichotomy. I had all this self-esteem because I knew that I was wanted in one hand, but I also knew that I didn't live in those countries and I was here. So I had to find other ways of measuring up. But I find that the last caller said it perfectly, bringing it out of the closet. You know, Sarah, you talk about how the young men, how they would like to use, not be seen with the overweight girls, but they would like to have sex with them. And that was completely my situation. Mm-hmm. Thank God, because of this self-esteem that I had found outside of this country, I didn't have to fall for that. And I had a different support system, but that was completely rampant. So it's not anything new. This has been going on for a very long time. And our society, I mean, I just think recently the Psychological Association has updated that, compulsive overeating is now a problem. Like, really now, I mean, we need the same type of, help, you know, and use the same type of interventions that you have for alcoholics, that you have for persons who have sex addictions across the board.
Okay, go ahead, Lisa. I was going to get Sarah to respond because you bring up some really interesting points about certain populations and how they view it differently. Sarah?
And I do spend a lot of time in the book actually looking at, to the extent that there's data available, I look very much at the racial and ethnic differences around weight gain and self-perception. One of the stories I had done years ago was looking at how African-American women who are overweight or obese will consider themselves to be, quote, normal weight, whereas normal weight women, white women, will consider themselves to be overweight. So obviously there's important racial and ethnic distinctions here. But what I found really interesting was, you know, there is this sort of, I think, need, and this is not what you're saying. You're saying you went outside the country and you saw these other body types, and that was very helpful for you to, in terms of your own self-worth, which is, of course, incredibly important. But what I found interesting was that it is not simply that African-American girls or Latino girls, Latinas, don't have these experiences as well. We do know that obesity, regardless of race or ethnicity, is associated with increased depression among teenage girls. So there are some ways in which race and ethnicity mitigate the impacts of obesity, but there's many ways in which it doesn't. And so I think, it was very interesting to talk to a lot of African-American girls, both in Mississippi but elsewhere in the country, who would say, look, I'm very clear that, yeah, I can get away with being a little bit bigger, but that shape has to be a certain way, that there's a certain standard still that I have to live up to as well.
I agree.
Okay, Lisa, well, thanks so much for calling and for your input.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And let's talk to Audrey in Miami Beach. Hi, Audrey.
Hi. Well, if you're really singing to the choir with this program, I really plan to get the book and read it. I'm a mid-50s woman with a BMI about 18, 19, and, exercise and keep myself up really nice. And I look at the men and I shudder to think what they look like without the clothes on, you know. I mean, they might have a nice smile or nice hair or nice voice. And, you know, you'd like to get to know them, but they're so big, you know. You just, some, you know, they all have these big fat stomachs and it's just such a turnoff. They say that the sex drive is the second strongest drive after our drive for self preservation, you know, the will to live. And then, I mean, how does it, don't they, I don't know, I guess, and I think the married guys keep it off more. Like, I think the married guys, you know, have an incentive being in a relationship to not get too big. But some of the, it's sad. I'm in despair over it.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, one of the things that we know from some of the social science is that we, both men and women, once they get married, do tend to gain weight. Men will gain much more weight when they're married. But I think you're right. I mean, one of the issues that I raise in the book, and I asked several urologists and endocrinologists around the country about this, was, you know, we've seen such an explosion in prescription drugs for Viagra, Cialis, low testosterone. And I really think that is actually masking much more widespread sexual dysfunction in men. So if you have, two-thirds of the population, two-thirds of men who are overweight and obese, and we know that for many of them that's going to increase the chances that they'll have low testosterone or that they'll have erectile dysfunction, if you can simply prescribe a pill to fix those things and you don't have to take the weight off, well, then that's sort of the problem is solved. And there's a urologist here in California who said to me, a lot of men will not go to the doctor. They don't want to go to the doctor, but they will go if somehow, their sex life is being interrupted. And there is a real debate among urologists and endocrinologists right now about what do you do first? Do you require the man to lose weight, or not require, but to suggest, say, I'm not going to prescribe you anything until you lose some weight because we're going to see your testosterone levels come back up naturally. Or do I give him that so that he starts to feel better about himself and that sort of, helps him to lose the weight? We don't know the answer to that question. But I do think that you're right in that there's probably, if you took away Viagra and Cialis and low testosterone treatments, all these other things, that the levels of sexual dysfunction would explode in the United States. And I think that would actually start to get men's attention.
I'm here to say to all the men out there, if you want to have sex, lose weight.
Okay, Audrey.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for calling. Tell us, Sarah, if you would, about Eric Lechby and his wife, where the roles were reversed, and Eric's self-loathing prevented him from even approaching the idea of sex with his wife.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we tend to think about weight as just something that women bear the burden of, but there are plenty, I'm here to tell you after having spent several years now talking with men around the country, that there are plenty of men for whom this is really on the top of their minds, and that the level of self-loathing can equal that of any woman out there. Eric's a great case. He's such a wonderful, spirited man. And he, in his 20s, he's, eating the same things he's eaten when he was a teenager. And obviously your metabolism starts to slow down. He doesn't get as much exercise and he starts to put on some weight. He and his girlfriend, they meet. They're both a little heavy. They get married. They start to put on weight together. And like many overweight couples, they really don't have any pictures of themselves, right? And this is a very common strategy when you're obese in particular, that you don't let anybody take a picture of yourself. You don't put pictures of yourself up on the walls. And it wasn't until they had been out on this one excursion, which I describe in the book, where somebody had taken a picture of them. And then the friends sent it to them, I think, in the mail. And they got this picture and they looked at it and they said, oh, my goodness, we had no idea that we had gotten this big. We got to do something about it. So they decide together. They're a great couple. They're such a perfect pair. Mm-hmm. They decide they're going to go get some help. And so they join this very supportive weight loss group that's here in San Francisco. That's very kind of, about nutrition and about exercise and about counseling. It's really the whole package. And then over the years, she loses the weight and has managed to keep it off. I mean, none of these people are slender. I mean, let's just be very clear. We're not talking about getting people to be, looking like the folks at the Emmys last night. I mean, this is just about bringing your weight down into some sort of normal range. Well, anyhow, Eric loses weight and then he gains weight back and then he loses it and then he gains it back. And what he really talks about is that when he's really down on himself and he's gaining weight and he's going through the drive-thru and he's, getting a burger and he takes the wrapper and he kind of stuffs it under the seat and then his wife finds it. And she, it feels like he has, he's lied to her and that he's let her down and that she now starts to wonder, well, what else can't I trust you with? And it creates all sorts of problems in their relationship. And so they have, for many years, been trying to do this. I mean, it is not a solved equation for them. They just now talk a lot about it, and his weight still fluctuates up and down. But, he gets to the point sometimes where when he's getting bigger, and he'll say, he just shuts down. He doesn't want to have anything. He doesn't want to be touched. He doesn't want to talk about anything physical, even if she's very encouraging. He just has this self-loathing that the previous caller talked about that you just hold on to. And it has been a lot of work for him to try and separate out. This is sort of what he's trying to do now, is to really separate out his weight from their sex life. and it is a it'll be a lifelong journey, I think, for him.
Right. Okay, and let's talk to Fiorella. We don't have much time, Fiorella, in Miami. Hi, welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to get your comment. I was overweight most of my life. I'm 25 now, and I ended up in an abusive relationship, like with domestic violence. And now, you know that I'm out of the relationship, looking back, that I feel, you know, a lot better about my body and I've lost weight. I actually think that it might have been related to the low self-esteem that I had most of my life. And I just wanted to get your comment on that.
Okay, thanks for calling, Fiorella.
Yeah, and absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up, because we actually meet a character in the book who lives in Las Vegas. She had been sexually abused as a child by her father. And what you see in the research is that there, among women who are obese and girls who are obese, there's a much higher rate of sexual abuse. It means shockingly higher. I think it's even 50% higher. So I started to talk to some adolescent psychologists about this, who specifically work with young girls and women who have been who were abused as girls. And they'll say that this makes sense, right? In the child's mind, it makes sense that there's two things at play. One, I want to make myself ugly, right? So how do I make myself ugly so that I'm not attractive to my abuser? I put on a lot of weight. And then the second thing is, I just physically want to protect myself, right? So if I put on all of this padding, if you will, somehow it's a protector against the abuse. And I think that this certainly extends to domestic violence as well. But also that sense of, this is, you know, this is what I deserve. I don't have any self-worth. Right. Therefore, you know, it's okay that he treats me this way. And in these therapy groups that I've gone to, when you talk to the therapists who work with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of these of couples and women and men individually, they'll say that, you know, there's a lot of women and men for sure. But in this case, there are a lot of women who, you know, got into really crappy relationships and really put up with a lot. And then once they lose this weight, again, it's not a panacea, but for them, somehow now they've come into their own. Now their self-worth tends to grow. And they say, you know what? This is not, I don't want this for myself. This is not okay. Right. Which is what that it sounds like you did, which is amazing. It's a lot of work.
Yeah. But then, you know, you gave me an epiphany right now, because I never related this to things. So I'm glad you made me come to that realization. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you so much for bringing up the issue, Fiorella, and all the best to you. Bye-bye. And Amanda writes an email, says, I was clinically obese about 2 years ago. It affected my relationship in a way that made me miserable. I was mean to my boyfriend. We had nothing but problems. And says she was not always overweight, but in her 20s went to 200 pounds. And her boyfriend said he loved her but didn't want to be intimate with her due to her weight. So she lost the weight, was more positive, had higher self-esteem, turned her life and relationship around, and still together after 5 years, and says, I do believe that being overweight can affect your love life. So we will conclude with that. Sarah Varney, it's been a really interesting hour. She is a senior health policy correspondent with Kaiser Health News. She's reported extensively on health policy and health disparities within the public health sphere. And reports can be heard on NPR and PBS NewsHour and written in the New York Times and other publications. She's written XL Love, How the Obesity Crisis is Complicating America's Love Life. Sarah, thanks so much, and for all your work that you've done.
Thank you so much, Bonnie. I really appreciate it. This has been great.
Oh, thank you so much. And that is our program for today. We thank you for spending your time with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from our online producer, Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, links, photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents. You can follow me on Twitter at Bonnie Berman. Tomorrow, we get the full picture of Florida's largest Ponzi scheme. Attorney Scott Rothstein bilked investors and charities of $1.4 billion. It's a Topical Currents rebroadcast. We visit with Chuck Malkus, author of The Ultimate Ponzi. Join us then. Bonnie Berman, hoping your day is a great one. Please stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.